Okay, so so Ratna Tudor spoke about Padmasambhava last week. That was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So Padmasambhava is the figure there that's just two above the Buddha in the back there. So he's often talked about as, he's a Tibetan teacher, sometimes talked about as the second Buddha. So he introduced Buddhism to Tibet. So I thought I'd stick, rather than jump around the tree, I thought I'd stick to the same cluster of people. So that the group of people there that are above the Buddha, and not the six at the top, but that cluster there are known as the teachers of the past. And so I'm going to talk about Kukai, who's the figure here that's second from the left, just above the Buddha's head. There, so he's holding a mala and he's holding a vajra, so a little guy there. So those the lowest four of those tier are Japanese teachers of the past. There's also the three above that are Chinese. Then you've got Tibetan, and then at the top you've got five Indian teachers. And just before I sort of go into Kukai a little bit, I just wanted to sort of remind us about the structure of the refuge tree, as it's called, and what it's for. So so in some ways it's a bit of a when lots of traditions have these, and they're basically representations of the tradition's lineage. So many Buddhist traditions go back, you know, sometimes thousands of years, and in that lineage they'll have lots of individuals. So it's in some ways the idea of lineage and transmitting teachings is really core in Buddhism. So with a lineage of Dharma teaching, we can track or trace Buddhist teachings all the way back to the Buddha. So, you know, fundamentally all these lineages go back to the Buddha. So Tri Ratna, and formerly the Western Buddhist Order, obviously it's a newer tradition. We're in our 50th year this year, but we still have a lineage. We still have a lineage in all the people that have transmitted Buddhist teachings down the ages, down the years, to today. And with this this sort of refuge tree, as it's described, our lineage is represented there. So the teachers of the past are teachers from different traditions who have made major contributions to the development or transmission of Buddhism over the millennia, really. Although they're from a range of different traditions, and we don't necessarily follow all their practices or ideals or so on and so forth, they represent significant, significant commitments to spiritual life, and people who have given their life to encourage Buddhism. And in one way or another, without them, the chances are that Buddhism wouldn't have survived these sort of 2,500 years to today, so we wouldn't have benefited from it. So in some ways they're there because we can sort of revere them, so we can respect them for what they've achieved, what they did. So yeah, okay, so Kukai, he's one of, as I said, one of four Japanese masters on the refuge tree. And yeah, he holds a vajra and a mala. And he's the founder of Shingon Buddhism.
Yeah. What are those two things?
What are those two things? Yeah. So a vajra is like a symbol. So a vajra is like, it's meant to represent like all the energy in the universe, basically.
Lightning.
That's it, yeah. You can translate a vajra as a diamond thunderbolt. So it's like a flash of insight arriving like a thunderbolt, but at the same time it's unbreakable. Like diamond is like the hardest substance, so it represents that. So you'll see it in a lot of figures, actually. I'm not actually sure what it originates from. I don't know if it's a Tibetan symbol or not. And then Mala is also, you know, known as sort of prayer beads, basically, and often associated with doing mantras. So you'd often use a mala to count mantras over and over. Some sort of traditions say that you need to count off 100,000 in your lifetime or whatever, or to be a certain practitioner. So one connection with Kukai is Shingon Buddhism translates as the school of the true word. So it's supposedly, from the source that I was reading, describes it as an esoteric mantra school. So a school whereby they have practices of doing, of just saying mantras over and over and over and over and over. That is one of their practices. So it could be that he's holding the mala in that connection. So Kukai is he did a lot for Buddhism. He's a great, regarded as a great interpreter, but also a great poet, and was renowned for his calligraphy as well. So you get this sense of a very sort of creative, artistic individual. One of his most famous poems, if you like, is called A Nobleman in Kyoto. And when I was coming to Buddhism, somebody read this out, or, you know, was on one of my first long retreats, and someone read this out, and it really, really struck me. And I find, yeah, I really like it. Really appeals to me. I don't quite know what it said to me, but it definitely spoke to me. And so I thought, you know, for Kukai, I could give you a sort of biography of his life and works, which is, you know, is quite interesting. But I thought, oh, it might be nicer to explore what emerges through his poem to start with. So I thought maybe we could explore that. And then, we'll sort of see what happens, basically. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is I'd like to read it to you. And then I suggest what we do is we break up into small groups, and we can just see what sort of strikes us or what comes out for us, basically. I might just turn this down a bit just for the... You ask me why I entered the mountain deep and cold. Awesome, surrounded by steep peaks and grotesque rocks. A place that is painful to climb and difficult to descend, wherein reside the gods of the mountain and the spirits of the trees. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, the peach and plum blossom in the royal garden? They must be in full bloom, pink and fragrant, now opening in the April showers, now falling in the spring gales, flying high and low. All over the garden the petals scatter. Some sprigs may be plucked by the strolling spring maidens, and flying petals picked by the flittering spring arillos. Oh, have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, the water gushing up in the divine spring of the garden? No sooner does it arise than it flows away forever. Thousands of shining lines flow as they come forth, flowing, flowing, flowing into an unfathomable abyss. Turning, whirling again, they flow on forever, and no one knows where they will stop. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, that billions have lived in China, in Japan? None have been immortal from time immemorial. Ancient sage kings or tyrants, good subjects or bad, fair ladies and homely, who could enjoy eternal youth? Noble men and lowly alike, without exception, die away. They have all died, reduced to dust and ashes. The singing halls and the dancing stages have become the abodes of foxes. Transient as dreams, bubbles or lightning, all are perpetual travellers. Have you not seen, oh, have you not seen, this has been man's fate, how can you alone live forever? Thinking of this, my heart always feels torn. You too are like the sun going down behind the western mountains, or a living corpse whose span of life is nearly over. Futile would my stay be in the capital. Away, away I must go. I must not stay there. Release me, for I shall be the master of the great void. A child of Shingon must not stay there. I have never tired of watching the pine trees and rocks at Mount Koya. The limpid stream of the mountain is the source of my inexhaustible joy. Discard pride in earthly gains. Do not be scorched in the burning house, the triple world. Discipline in the woods alone lets us soon enter the eternal realm. So I find that really provocative, basically, that that poem or that letter. So I thought what we could do is maybe if we break up into, so why don't we have two groups of three and a group of four. I've got some, I probably don't have quite enough for one each, but we can definitely have a couple per group. I'd just like you to talk about basically what comes out for you. Is there anything in that poem that sort of sticks out, anything that moves you, anything you're not sure about, anything that sort of what comes out, basically what comes out. And so we'll have maybe 10 minutes to talk in groups, and then we'll just open up to the floor. And I've miscounted, haven't we? I've counted right. So two groups of three and a four. So what I'd recommend is maybe go with some people you don't know so well. So I'll let you organize yourselves. Oh yeah, he was. He was born in 774. So he lived for until about. He lived till 835. Mm. So yeah, it's over 1,000 years old. Yeah. Okay, so let's so what emerged for people? Anybody want to like to share any comments? Let's just so anybody like to share what arose for them, or any questions or comments?
We all kind of felt that it was very strongly that it was to do with impermanence and beauty. Mm. The two were sort of quite linked. Mm. Yeah, that was sort of one of the early things that we kind of talked about and explored, that it's a very strong thread running throughout.
Mm. And did you talk about your responses to that, whether it was positive or negative or...?
I sort of felt it as a bit of a wake-up call,
Have you not seen
all the way through? Yeah. It's kind of really challenging you to look at what matters in life.
Mm. Mm. I think my favourite line is none have been immortal from time immemorial.
Yes. That's
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm always quite, particularly this time around, that his response to impermanence is to withdraw, is solitude.
Mm.
Whereas, another response could be being in connection with people who share your ideals and talking about it like we are now. But his response is, this is away, I must away from the capital. This is the woods that
you kind of get the impression there's a lot of hassle going on in the capital, yeah, don't you? Yeah. And he wants to get away from it all.
Yeah.
I sort of feel like that sometimes in London.
Yeah.
To escape.
I was just remembering the Buddha's life, where sometimes it just bit too much, all the teaching, he just go off in the jungle.
Mm.
I have a sense that also that's the mind, it's all the busyness of your mind, that there can be moments of stillness, just moments of presence, fleeting perhaps, where there's just a real seeing of something, noticing something small, we lift, we feel. So yeah, I find it quite lovely as a sort of invitation to return.
I've never actually seen it like that, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's an interesting reading there to think about it like that way.
Yes, well, the Royal Garden is as beautiful and as transient as the mountain. There's flowing water everywhere, isn't there?
And the petals in the wind. Yeah.
And I think, Nigel, you were saying that, you know, it starts out making it sound quite austere what he's doing in these mountains. But there's a joyfulness in the end.
Yeah, we picked up on that too. Yeah. That by the end, the way the mountains were being presented was something of great peace and beauty, whereas at the beginning it was more of a difficult struggle somehow. Which, you know, could be a metaphor, I suppose, for the spiritual life in a way, couldn't it? But, you know, it can be pretty rocky at times, and then, you know, you break through to sort of something more joyful and peaceful or something.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's also, you know, it's sort of commenting on the fact that people see things different ways, don't they? Because, you know, it's the form is the letter to the nobleman in Kyoto, and, you know, the... It starts with you ask me why, so clearly the nobleman doesn't understand the value of solitude or the mountains, whereas obviously for Kukai it's extremely beautiful and pleasurable to be up in the mountains. Yeah. Any other comments?
Just a bit of an obscure one. When you were reading it, I went back to when I was still at Rivendell. I was hearing bits that I heard as in Rivendell, and it's 18 years since I left the retreat centre. But that was what I was hearing, not you. I was hearing all the other... We had this so many times at Rivendell, and that's what I heard. Just, you know, it was just like an echo coming through. So this was very strong for me.
I mean, I certainly have a connection to it. When I hear it read on a retreat, I go back to when I first heard it. It's very provocative for me. Okay, good. I mean, yeah, it's really, really nice to explore that. I mean, in some ways, that's there's so much in there. I think you could explore that for a long time. I did want to give you a bit of his biography, because I think actually for me the poem really came alive once I'd read into his life a bit more and understood a bit more about the perspective. So I'll give you a little bit of information about him. So Kukai was born in 774 into an aristocratic family, and he excelled quite early on in reading Chinese. He was taken off by his... He had an uncle, and he was taken off to the capital so he could continue with his studies of Chinese. And while he was there, he got very interested in studying Buddhist scriptures. Now, the chances are around this time, actually, a lot of these traditions have developed out of just one or two teachings. It's not like today, where we've got access to the entire sort of Buddhist, historical accounts and to all the suttas. Very, very, very few translations would have actually made it into Japan. Those would have been from China, who again, had even fewer from India. So actually, chances are there wasn't much around at the times. So Kukai spent his early life trying to learn from yeah, I guess like people who knew about the scriptures. But in his words, he felt as though he was learning from the dregs of old men. So he was unsatisfied with the with the thinking that was around at the time. And at age 20, he withdrew into the mountains to undertake the sort of ascetic practices and meditative practices. And it said during this time he found this this beautiful location in Mount Koya, which was a very secluded area surrounded by mountains on all sides. And he recognized it as a place of great potential for spiritual practice. He stayed in solitude for some time, and at 24 he decided that he wanted to devote himself to understanding the highest teachings. So his vow was that I, disciple Kukai, being driven by an inner urge, had all the while thought of returning to the source. Not knowing the way to it, I cried many a time standing at the crossroad. My sincere wish was rewarded, however. I found this, the esoteric Buddhist approach. I started reading the Mahavirochana Sutta, only to find that I was unable to understand it. I wished to visit China. So you get this sense of a man who's on this quest to understand the teachings which he'd been exposed to. When he was 32, he made the journey to China. And yeah, at that time, 1,000 years ago, it would have been an extremely hazardous journey. So firstly, you would have had to made it across the ocean from Japan to China. And you know, China's a vast country, so he would have had to be a pilgrim in China with all of the presumably there was quite a lot of banditry around at the time, lots of thieves and criminals and so on. He traveled in China, and then at one point he met a great Chinese master called Hui Ko. And apparently he said that he walked in with five or six others that had come to visit the master. And the master, as soon as he saw him, said, "Thank goodness you've come, I've been waiting for you." So he recognized him as his successor. So he's this old man. And so within, Kukai then received an initiation from this Chinese master, and within 3 months he'd become the head of this school. Had been handed on the I don't know what you call it, the principalship of this religious group. And the master told him to basically gave him all of the teachings that he had available, and told him to go back and establish this form of Buddhism in Japan. So Kukai returned to Japan, and he gradually rose to prominence. So he became an advisor to the imperial court, and the emperor he petitioned the emperor to grant him this land in Mount Koya to build a monastery. So he was granted this land and set about this great work to establish his monastery in the mountains. And it was said that he, despite being advisor to the court, was often there supervising the works. And so this letter would have been written about that time. So he would have been in the mountains establishing the monastery, and this letter would have been somebody entreating him to come back. You might imagine it might have been for court business or something, like, why are you not back here helping us run this or that? And he's writing to explain to them how they don't understand the importance of establishing this monastery in the mountains, and also of solitude and so on. So many monasteries followed, not within all within Kukai's lifetime. But at its height, Shingon Buddhism, which he established, had over 10,000 temples in Japan and claims to have had over 10 million adherents. So, yeah, so it became one of the two big Japanese schools. So in some ways, as founder, he was outstandingly successful in terms of helping to propagate and maintain Buddhism, in this case in Japan. But he's also known for his other great works as well. So he particularly founded a school of arts and sciences, and it was the first school in Japan that didn't discriminate based on financial financial means and social status. So he, in some ways it was a great sort of representation of his recognition of equality of all people. He was a big proponent of supporting education. And he also established, he wrote this great work called the ten Stages of the Development of the Mind. And so mainly it was laying out the teachings of his school. But interestingly, it was also it also took account of other schools' teachings. So it took account of other Buddhist and non-Buddhist schools of thought with regard to, the sort of nature of reality. And it's sort of interesting to look at the refuge tree in relation to that, because, of course, that's in some ways what has been done here as well. So, we as Triratna and the Western, previously the Western Buddhist Order, taken account of, our tradition, if you like, goes back to basic Buddhism, but it takes its influence from lots of different ranges of Buddhist thought and different Buddhist schools. In some ways, that's a natural, the natural way Buddhism has spread. It's moved from culture to culture, and in each culture, it's established teachings and practices with which it's needed to be effective within those cultures. And so in some way Kukai was laid that out in one of his great works, and that process continues today in our movement, drawing inspiration from other schools. That's Kukai, really. He actually withdrew more and more as he got older, and eventually died in the 835, actually on Mount Koya, on retreat, basically, on his retreat. So any further comments or questions, reflections? Apparently, yeah.
More than that, it's very close to Triratna. It's kind of system of practice, as I understand it. And Ex-Vajrabodhi lived in Japan and moved to Japan 30 years ago to teach. He became very interested and got very, very involved in Shingon. And he stayed in touch, and I could have talked to Sangharaksha about Vajrabodhi. He needed to go deeper and deeper into it, and the Shingon priests wouldn't give him the real deep teachings unless he resigned from Triratna. So he wrote to Bhante and said, "Look, I really want to do this." And Bhante said, "I'll let you go peacefully," or something like that, he told him. It's not pushing away, he really wanted it. He was heartless, torn. There's very, very, very secret teaching. It's a tantra in Japan. Very, very secret. But it has strands of, it's very much a system of practice that takes you deeper and deeper, rather than higher and higher.
I know it's a school that has a structure of having initiation, so you can't it's said that you can't understand the teaching until you've been initiated by somebody, so somebody has sort of passed it on to you. But I did wonder if it was connected to, is it Soka Gakkai? Do they do, unrelated? Okay.
But you started out by saying it was an esoteric teaching.
Yeah.
That kind of implies hidden or...
secret, yeah.
Secret, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to go to the wooden stoop at Woodendown. Frantically, I was corresponding with him. He sent me to France, but he got it from the priest. And he said, I'm not giving you this. So he got me France with the wooden stoop. And Roach was in the middle of it.
Okay, so suggest with the last few minutes, if we just sort of sit quietly or sit in meditation posture, what I'll do is I'll read it again and then we can finish the evening. So just keeping a broad awareness of how you feel, the body, emotions. Just sitting. You ask me why I entered the mountain deep and cold. Awesome, surrounded by steep peaks and grotesque rocks, a place that is painful to climb and difficult to descend, wherein reside the gods of the mountain and the spirits of trees. Have you not seen, oh have you not seen, the peach and plum blossom in the royal garden? They must be in full bloom, pink and fragrant, now opening in the April showers, now falling in the spring gales. Flying high and low, all over the garden the petals scatter. Some sprigs may be plucked by the strolling spring maidens, and the flying petals picked by the flittering spring arillos. Oh, have you not seen? Oh, have you not seen the water gushing up in the divine spring of the garden? No sooner does it arise than it flows away forever. Thousands of shining lights flow as they come forth, flowing, flowing, flowing into an unfathomable abyss. Turning, whirling again, they flow on forever. And no one knows where they will stop. Have you not seen, oh have you not seen, that billions have lived in China, in Japan, none have been immortal from time immemorial, ancient sage kings or tyrants, good subjects or bad, fair ladies and homely, who could enjoy eternal youth? Noble men and lowly alike, without exception, die away. They have all died, reduced to dust and ashes. The singing halls and the dancing stages have become the abodes of foxes. Transient as dreams, bubbles or lightning, all are perpetual travellers. Have you not seen? Oh, have you not seen? This has been man's fate. How can you alone live forever? Thinking of this, my heart always feels torn. You, too, are like the sun going down behind the western mountains, or a living corpse whose span of life is nearly over.
futile would my stay in the capital. Away, away, I must go. I must not stay there. Release me, for I shall be the master of the great void. A child of Shingon must not stay there. I have never tired of watching the pine trees and rocks at Mount Koya. The limpid stream of the mountain is the source of my inexhaustible joy. Discard pride in earthly gains. Do not be scorched in the burning house, the triple world. Discipline in the woods alone lets us soon enter the eternal realm. We've got time for.